Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Unredacted. My esteemed co-host, Q Anthony, has stumbled into the room, as is his wont, a couple of seconds after we've begun. Can you hear me, Q?
Yeah, I can hear you. Stumbled into the room?
I mean, that's how I pictured you. You were a little late. You had first trouble of getting all, in. So I figured you like
we were literally in the group chat. No, you were in the group chat. Where the fuck is this room?
Spill the beans, Q.
Yeah, exactly.
Let them know.
Don't you?
I know, but then I regained my sense of certainty and I found it. And you weren't here, so I was picturing you like in some weird digital labyrinth wandering around lost. But anyway, I'm glad you made it safely.
No, I'm glad to be here too. How are you feeling, by the way? I thought you was dead. I tried checking in on you earlier this week. You didn't pick up your phone.
No, what happened was I have been like it's been a source of pride of mine that I never once got COVID, and it's not like I've been hiding out at home. I've been very much circulating out and about, and I've been very proud of.
What's all that got to do with you picking up your phone?
I wasn't feeling well, so I went to get various tests, one of which was COVID, and it came back positive. So psychologically, I convinced myself I had all these symptoms, and the next day I went back for a second test just to confirm, and it was negative. Then the next day I went back, and it was negative again, so clearly the first one was a false positive, continuing my streak of extreme health and immunological excellence.
Okay.
And... I just disappeared for a while because I like psychosomatically convinced myself I had COVID symptoms.
Okay. I mean, I was sick as hell last week too, but, you didn't see me crying about it.
You doing better?
Yeah, much better actually. No, I shouldn't even, don't let me even front. Cause I was curled up in my bed like a baby on last week's Saturday, as he was coming in, putting a cold cloth to my head and everything. I don't know, but no, it wasn't COVID either. Rapid test came back negative. So, it is what it is. Summertime cold.
It's really amazing how just getting like sick, just even kind of
scary
like
scary as hell now, isn't it? Sick. Yeah.
For one thing, yeah, it just like it raises the anxiety level, but also it's just weird. No matter how far into adulthood you are, it just still reduces you to this childhood whininess, where you just want your mommy and you want to be taken care of, and you suck so bad. You're just in bed for 3 days or 4 days, feeling crappy. But yeah, it's good that we're back to being a healthy podcast team.
Yeah, whatever the fuck. Fine, I'll say it. I missed you. I missed you just a little bit.
Thank you.
Yeah. Missing presence. Anyway, in the meantime, while you were gone, it's not like, the world let up a little bit. It's only gotten more insane as each week passes. So, apparently after... all that talk about peace, democracy, human rights, all that shit, where it came to Russia, Biden is now off to go touch his toes for the Saudis. And I don't even like to bring this up. Let me not even front. I do kind of like bringing it up, but only so that I can yell at people. Because I used to be one to... avoid the culture war stuff. I used to think, oh my god, with all the things happening in the world, why are we still going over this stupid ass culture war bullshit? And I'm slowly starting to realize it actually is important, because by not addressing matters in what we deem the culture war or discourse or whatever, we actually can't talk about matters of more import, because people are just like constantly distracted by this shiny dangling object that is, I don't know, what do you want to call it, like woke politics or whatever the fuck it is. It's like there's this inability for people to focus on matters that actually have any meaning or importance, because they constantly have to be validated and constantly have to feel affirmed. And I'm getting to the point now where I think this like this culture of affirmation is actually stunting us as a society. Because if you don't feel affirmed in other people's language, where are you going to be able to generate that from? Right, like if you can't generate it yourself, where is it going to come from? And if you have matters that are of importance to not just you, but other people like you or people that share your same material position, then how do you actually get to focus on those matters if we are in constant internecine warfare over how does people speak to or about you? And this, like, this comes from a really airheaded fucking academic place that I've never been comfortable with and I personally don't like, because academics to me are the type who are paid and make an entire career out of staring up their own asses while people starve. Like, yes, we do need, rigorous study. We do need empiricism. And we also do need philosophies underpinning the work that we undertake, especially in this rapidly changing world where apparently AIs are coming alive. And at the same time, the downside to it is we have this endless conversation about power and power dynamics and privilege. And frankly, it's just, I don't know, it's enabled probably the worst generation of narcissists. And I know that every generation says this about the next, but I'm sorry, like, the level of, like self-centeredness, entitlement, and straight-up narcissism, I don't think I've ever seen it worse than it is right now. So anyway, culture war shit.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I've been thinking about this quite a bit. First of all, this phrase culture war, I think, is always very vaguely defined. I'm always surprised when critics of mine claim that I'm focusing on the culture war more than I have previously, because to me, you know, the culture war generally means topics about which I almost never speak or write. The abortion debate, LGBTQ issues. I don't know what else you want to put in there. I guess like gender ideology, you know, and it's not necessarily because I don't think those are important. They're important to a lot of people. They're just not the things that I focus on. And I think people have started to take other issues that are genuinely important, but that they want to minimize for a variety of reasons and try and cram them into the culture war, under the culture war umbrella in order to avoid having to talk about them. And I think what people mean when they say that, for example, about me is that I write a lot about and talk a lot about the growing formal corporate state regime of censorship that has emerged on the internet that obviously has a cultural component to it in terms of what is and isn't permissible to express, what ideas can subject you to loss of job and loss of reputation, but it has a very consequential policy component obviously to it too, a very concrete dimension about whether the internet, which is supposed to be this tool that enabled us as citizens to organize by communicating directly with one another without the need for the mediation of large corporations and governments to be able to organize against ruling class power, that instead these same ruling class power centers that were supposed to be made more vulnerable by the internet have instead increasingly commandeered it with increasing levels of repression. To me, that is the opposite of a culture war issue. That is the sort of issue that has, you know, multi-pronged consequences for everything, single thing we debate, whether it be how we organize our society economically, militarism and imperialism, because all of this is being subject to increasing levels of discourse control. So that's one thing, is I think the whole term culture war is starting to get exploitatively weaponized as a way of taking issues that a lot of people don't want to talk about. A lot of people don't want to talk about that free speech issue because it doesn't have an immediate partisan angle. And many people are interested only in things that have partisan advantage or disadvantage and kind of dismisses importance by putting it under that rubric. The other thing is, Freddie DeBoer has this new essay, which, and for those of you who don't know who Freddie is, he's been on the left.
He's canceled. That's what it is. He's canceled.
Yeah, he's canceled. I mean, he did, you know, he's been very upfront about the mental health struggles that he had that caused some public behavior that was actually worthy of condemnation. He's been very candid about, you know, owning that and apologizing for it. And for me, you know, especially given what was not the particularly grave nature of those transgressions, the fact that he went away for a while and really worked on himself and came back, you know, rehabilitation is more than merited. for me, he's one of the smartest and most astute commentators. He wrote this essay on Substack. And before I talk about this essay, I'll just tell you this anecdote that he once shared, I think in his writing, maybe like in 2016 or 2017, that really impacted me. He was teaching at Purdue University. He was a grad student there in the PhD program and was teaching a course. And Purdue is a place where a lot of wealthy people go. And in his class, he was, you know, it's mostly a liberal student body. He was telling me how there was this one student of his who had served in Iraq. He's Latino. He was the first person in his family to go to college. He came from the South, from a conservative family, and having served in Iraq made him start questioning a lot of the things he was taught to believe about the U.S. security state, U.S. foreign policy, the role the U.S. plays in the world, exactly what, if you're on the left, you want people like that to kind of start questioning. And he was really starting to kind of transform his politics and in very productive ways. And at one point, there was something they were discussing, and just being not very connected to elite liberal discourse, he kind of used like a wrong word. I don't mean like a maliciously racist word. I mean, just like, I don't remember exactly what it was. It was just a word that had fallen out of favor within like the last 7 seconds. And he was talking about how all these kind of rich, privileged white students who had been steeped in private education and the like, who were actually paying for that school, in contrast to him, who was there on a scholarship, basically mauled him, you know, declared him a bigot and off limits for what was at worst, you know, kind of a language mistake, absolutely devoid of any malice. And this has been, you know, a kind of hobby horse of his, I wouldn't say ever since, but already it was, but that really accelerated it, this idea that there are all these, you know, concrete, important deprivations and injustices that emanate from the ruling elite that can unite people across ideological lines. That is what you want if you actually care about politics. But that instead, these kind of performative, theatrical gestures have taken precedence over actually caring about outcomes, actually caring about changing society, which is really the only purpose of politics. Like, if you don't care about changing society, there's no point in even bothering with politics. And so he has this essay that is probably not for everybody, but it kind of seeks to describe this one particular strain of very cloying liberal discourse where, as he puts it, people are thinking about politics not in terms of what they can do, but in terms of proving who they are, meaning like proving they're a good person instead of actually trying to get anything done and change anything. And he kind of uses what he calls the good white male ally, these people who kind of exist and survive in liberal discourse by constantly trying to show that, you know, they're good people, by volunteering to exclude other people from the discourse in order to show that they're the good kinds of white males, they're the allies, and are kind of in the lead of, you know, banishing others. And I mean, I think if you read it, I think it really sheds a lot of light on what you're describing and why it's happening, because what it essentially means is people are interested in how they're being perceived and what their brand is at the expense of anything that matters.
Yeah. Okay. So I did read that article. Are you referring to the New York Times article in which Ezra Klein interviewed David Shore?
You mean Freddie's article?
Yeah. He wrote an article that was about Ezra Klein for the New York Times interviewing David Shore, and David Shore was the one that lost his job for linking.
Right. He writes about similar themes. This article was written in the last few days. He like chose a bunch of examples, like Chris Hayes was one of his leading examples. I mean, he just chose all the perfect people and wrote little sections on how it manifests in each of them. So right. No, I don't. I think we're talking about different articles, but they probably have a similar theme. What's the one that you're talking about?
Okay. He referenced an article, or an academic article, that talked about the 2020 protests, some of which, you know, turned into riots.
And just give the, do you want to just give the background on David Shore and why he became a kind of known and controversial figure? So people,
oh my god, no, you can go ahead and get the background because I don't know that much.
Yeah,
about
I mean,
it.
I basically
that he lost his
basically,
job.
Basically,
yeah.
Basically, he's this kind of data-driven liberal who argues that Democrats have alienated huge numbers of voters, such as, you know, working class. The multiracial working class, basically. It used to just be the white working class. Now it's the black working class, the Latino working class, as we just saw last night in these elections, the night before in Texas.